Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 8th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows Kamala Harris. I actually think it's a computer-generated thing because her face looks like a real picture of her face and her hands, but the rest of it's animated. She's wearing a dark suit, and she's jumping, making a huge leap between two cliffs. There's a large gap underneath her, mountains in the background. The headline is, Can She Land It? Harris makes her final drive for votes in a historically close race. And I should note this as I'm recording this on Wednesday morning. We do know now that Donald Trump won the electoral vote. The jury's still out on the overall popular vote, but it looks as though Mr. Trump is our president-elect. So we may skip the first main story. I think I will start with the editor's letter today. If Donald Trump is returned to power next week, it will be because of millions of people did not believe him. He can't win with hardcore MAGA acolytes alone, the 43% or so of the electorate who thrilled to Trump's vow to prosecute political opponents like Liz Cheney for treason, to deploy U.S. soldiers on the streets to suppress protests by the enemy within, to ally America with Putin's Russia, and to hunt down and deport millions of vermin who are poisoning the blood of our country. The votes Trump needs to put him back in office will have to come from people who dismiss his fascist stylings as showman's bluster. These are the voters who concede Trump is obnoxious, but just want him to close the border and somehow bring the price of eggs and gas back to 2019 levels. When Trump sounds like an unhinged authoritarian, it could just be for publicity, just riling up the news. Trump voter Mario Facchini, 40, recently explained to the New York Times, I think the media blows stuff out of proportion. To dismiss Trump's ravings as shtick requires a curious form of amnesia. Just 4 years ago, Trump refused to accept his election defeat and incited a violent insurrection at the Capitol. In his first term, horrified top aides repeatedly refused to carry out orders they viewed as illegal or potentially disastrous, including calling out the National Guard to shoot protesters. General Mark Milley, the former Joint Chiefs chairman who ignored that demand, describes Trump as a fascist to the core. If Trump returns to office, he and his allies say he'll fill his cabinet, the Pentagon, and every agency with MAGA loyalists who will not subvert his will. Even the law will not constrain him now that a blatantly partisan Supreme Court that Trump shaped has ruled that the president's official acts are immune from prosecution. Being inside Trump's White House was terrifying, said former National Security official Olivia Troy. But what keeps me up at night is what will happen if he gets back there. The guardrails are gone. And we'll read the main story having to do with Congress. Republicans hold edge in race to control Congress. What happened? As candidates for Congress embarked on their last flurry of campaigning this week, Republicans appeared primed to retake the Senate, while the fight for the House of Representatives remains a toss-up. In the Senate, the GOP needs just two pickups to flip the chamber and one to tie. It has one of those virtually guaranteed in deep red West Virginia, where Senator Joe Manchin is retiring after leaving the Democratic Party in May, and another likely candidate in Montana, where incumbent Senator John Tester has polled behind Republican challenger Tim Sheehy for months. In Ohio, Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown was running neck and neck with Colombian-born businessman Bernie Moreno. in the nation's most expensive Senate race, with combined spending surpassing $310 million. And in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, crucial swing states for Democrats in the presidential race as well, Democratic incumbents have seen their polling leads shrink in recent weeks. Three-term Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey asked a crowd in Philadelphia to just keep praying. In the House, where Speaker Mike Johnson presides over a narrow four-seat Republican majority, poll aggregator 538 gave Democrats a nearly even chance of retaking the chamber. While forecasters consider only about two dozen races to be truly competitive, Democrats are mounting serious challenges in those, particularly in several New York and California districts that went red in 2022. Donald Trump, though, implied that none of those races mattered, saying that Republicans were guaranteed control of the House thanks to a little secret he and Johnson shared. Pundits and some Democrats speculate that Trump was referring to a scheme to delay certification of states' votes or even to overturn the election results outright. But Johnson scoffed. "It's not diabolical," he said, "just a plan to get out the vote." Well, the columnist said, "This is probably the worst map in modern political history for Senate Democrats," said Domenico Montanaro in NPR.org. "They have to defend twice as many seats as Republicans and are contending with deep pockets of GOP-like linked super PACs, which just unleashed a $42 million ad blitz in the blue wall states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Ohio. And Arizona may be in play as Republican election denier Carrie Lake is closing in on Representative Ruben Gallego in the race to replace independent Kyrsten Sinema. Republicans have learned from their mistakes," said Ben Dominick in The Spectator. "In 2022, they lost their chance for a Senate red wave by nominating Trump loyalists who lacked both cash and mainstream appeal, such as Arizona's Blake Masters and Georgia's Herschel Walker. This time, they have stuck to the fundamentals, elevating credible candidates such as handsome Navy SEAL Tim Sheehy from Montana and former House Intelligence Committee Chair Mike Rogers from Michigan. Still, Democrats hope for a blue miracle," said Sudishka Kochi in USA Today. In Texas, some polls indicate Democrat Representative Colin Allred, a former NFL linebacker, has reached a virtual dead heat with Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Allred calls Cruz an election denier who skipped off to Mexico during the state's crippling 2021 power outages. "Democrats have more realistic prospects in the House," said Katia Gova and David Weigel in Semaphore, where a win would make Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, the Democrat from New York, the first black speaker in history. Their surprise challenges have forced the GOP to massively boost spending in suburban districts of New York and California, represented by Republican freshmen. In the Midwest, too, Democrats are targeting Representative Marionette Miller Meeks of Iowa, who has been forced to defend her party's abortion ban, and Wisconsin Representative Derek Van Orden, who was caught cussing out a group of school-aged Senate pages. "Both houses flipping at once is something never seen before in American history," said Harry Enten in CNN.com. "But it could happen. Much will depend on who wins the presidential election, as straight-ticket voting will let House candidates ride the incoming president's coattails. If Republicans achieve a trifecta of House, Senate, and presidency, they could radically reshape the country," said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. "They plan to pass sweeping tax cuts, offset by slashing anything benefiting the poor, and possibly even entitlements that many Americans rely on." Johnson has also vowed to gut Obamacare. That probably isn't what swing voters hope for in a Trump administration billing itself as offering a return to American greatness, but it's what they'll get in a Republican sweep. controversy of the week. Bezos. Why he spiked his paper's endorsement of Harris. In Donald Trump's first presidential term, the Washington Post adopted a bold new slogan, "Democracy dies in darkness." But last week, democracy died in broad daylight, said Jill Abramson in the Boston Globe. 11 days before the election, the Post's multi-billionaire owner, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, personally killed an endorsement of Kamala Harris from his paper's editorial board. Post publisher William Lewis claimed the paper was simply returning to its pre-1976 roots of not endorsing presidential candidates. Yet the timing was suspect. Hours after the endorsement was nixed, Trump met privately with executives from Bezos' aerospace firm, Blue Origin, which has a multi-billion-dollar NASA contract. Trump's threat to punish his foes, chief among them a free press, clearly got to Bezos. "He's not alone in obeying fascism in advance," said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. 3 days earlier and 3,000 miles west, biotech billionaire and Los Angeles Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong spiked his paper's Harris endorsement. Both papers are now enduring waves of canceled subscriptions, a reported 250,000 in the Post case, 10% of total circulation, and resignations from their editorial board. These billionaire cowards are willing to pay that price and more to appease an autocrat who, if reelected, is sure to bring down the hammer in full force. Bezos' decision makes a lot of sense, said Mark Antonio Wright in National Review. As he explained this week in a Post op-ed, newspaper endorsements have minimal impact on voters, but they do create the perception of bias. With public trust in the media at an all-time low, and readers abandoning the mainstream media to get their news from social media and podcast, ending partisan endorsements is a meaningful step toward rebuilding the Post's credibility. The cynics are correct that this was a business decision, just not in the way they think, said Jeffrey Blahar, also in National Review. As the official organ of the resistance, the Post saw readership spike in Trump's first term, then plummet after 2021. Bezos is simply adjusting to the fact that breathless anti-Trumpism doesn't sell anymore. But killing a Harris endorsement, just as the conventional wisdom was shifting to expect a Trump win, stinks to high heaven, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. Trump's brightening prospects may have reminded Bezos that in 2019, the then-president punished him for the Post's disloyalty by killing a $10 billion Pentagon contract for Amazon. Other ultra-wealthy Americans are now hedging their political bets to avoid being stamped as Trump enemies, said Jeff Stein in the Washington Post. From Warren Buffett to Bill Gates to Mark Zuckerberg, billionaires who have previously endorsed Democrats have kept quiet this cycle. Meanwhile, CEOs are strategizing about how best to protect themselves and their companies if Trump wins. People are underestimating what happened at the Washington Post, said Jonathan V. Last in the Bulwark. Yes, Bezos bending the knee to Trump raises troubling questions about press freedom. If Bezos will kill a meaningless endorsement to preemptively mollify Trump, why would he balk at spiking a damaging news story? But the real lesson here is about a catastrophic failure of the rule of law that has already happened. If the third richest person on the planet can't trust Congress or the courts to protect him from a vindictive president, we are no longer teetering at the precipice of a slide into autocracy. We are already partway down the slope. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for never forgetting. After a large brass sculpture of a poop emoji on a desk was erected near the U.S. Capitol by an unknown artist, a plaque declares that the memorial honors the brave men and women who broke into the Capitol on January 6, 2021, to loot, urinate, and defecate throughout those hallowed halls in order to overturn an election. it was a good week for toppings, after police in Dusseldorf, Germany, raided a pizzeria whose pizza number 40 was allegedly served with a bag of cocaine hidden under the pie. It was one of the most sold pizzas, said police. It's a good week for family planning after the New York Times reported that Elon Musk had spent $35 million acquiring adjacent mansions in Austin that he envisions as a future compound for his 11 children and two of their three mothers, and that he's offered his own sperm to friends and acquaintances with a view to increasing the planet's population. But it was a bad week for motivational speaking after Boston Celtics head coach Joe Mazzulla told reporters that his team feels zero pressure to repeat last year's championship season because we're all going to be dead soon and it really doesn't matter anymore. It was a bad week for progress after a radio station in Poland ended what it claimed was the experiment of replacing its human on-air journalist with virtual AI-generated presenters. In a statement, the station's chief said the goal had merely been to spark debate about AI and that he'd been taken aback by the deluge of harsh judgments from listeners. And it was a bad week for Google after a Russian court ordered the tech giant to pay a fine of $20 decillion. That's 20 followed by 33 zeros for banning 17 Russian propaganda channels from YouTube. The market capitalization of Alphabet, Google's parent company, is only $2 trillion. And a short and other news piece. U.S. apologizes for abuse of Native American children. President Biden apologized to Native Americans last week for the systemic abuse of children inside government-funded Indian schools that forced assimilation between 1819 and 1869. Speaking at the tribally controlled Gila Crossing Community School in Levine, Arizona, Biden called the abuse, which the federal government started investigating in 2021, one of the most horrific chapters in American history. The government's final report said of the 18,000 Native American children who were forced to attend federal boarding schools across 37 states, at least 973 died due to abuse. Some were buried in unmarked graves. Others who survived were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused. Biden, who is making his first visit to an indigenous reservation as president, said, "We learn from history and remember so we can heal as a nation." Moving into the best columns, we'll take two from the U.S. What mass deportation would mean. We are not taking the Trump-Vance deportation plan seriously enough, said Timothy Snyder. The proposal to deport more than 12 million undocumented immigrants would require massive militarized roundups and rip apart lives, businesses, families, and communities. There are 20 million mixed-status immigrant families in this country. Deportation would separate their members, with children born here losing a parent or both parents. Virtually everyone will know people who are arrested and deported. Your son's girlfriend, the mom next door, the business owner on the corner. A purge on this scale will necessitate an army of informers and divert law enforcement from policing real crime. Latinos would face pressure to collaborate in the deportation effort and name people in the community who are undocumented. Amid sweeps by police and National Guard, many people would go into hiding. Inevitably, some will resist their capture violently. Such violence is part of the plan because it will serve to justify claims that the undocumented are dangerous criminals. Trump's deportation plan will instill a politics of us and them. Once this regime of government intimidation and fear gathers momentum, it will be hard to stop. Conservatism after Trump is gone. For traditional conservatives, this year's presidential election has been a dispiriting affair, said Charles C.W. Cook. The choices between an old-school San Francisco progressive, now posing as a moderate, and Donald Trump, a capricious, narcissistic old man who tried to steal the 2020 election and has no understanding of the Constitution, the limits of federal power, or the dangers of tariffs and massive deficits. He is a long, long way from being a conservative. Small government conservatives are politically homeless, but when Trump finally departs the scene, he will take much of the Trumpist populism with him. Larger-than-life politicians rarely hand their ideologies over successfully. The good news is that traditional conservatism is alive and well in state governments such as Georgia, Ohio, Texas, and Florida. These states are demonstrating the popularity of low taxes, business deregulation, free markets, and school choice. The central insights of conservatism remain true. Central planners cannot engineer utopia or change human nature, and we cannot spend more than we make. From time to time, we take a vacation from these truths, but eventually, reality will kick in. And this is one of the international columns. Israel, a restrained retaliation against Iran. A swarm of Israeli fighter jets has reduced Iran's most advanced air defenses to flaming wrecks, said Yossi Yehoshua. Operation Days of Repentance sent 150 warplanes and drones 1,000 miles from home to destroy 20 Iranian military targets in three provinces, including all four of the S-300 surface-to-air missile systems Iran got from Russia. The attack, retaliation for the barrage of some 200 missiles Iran launched against Israel nearly a month ago, also blasted factories that produce ballistic missiles, which means it took out two of Iran's critical military capabilities, both offensive missiles and air defenses. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian said Iran would give an appropriate response, but tamped down expectations, saying that Tehran did not want all-out war. While he is clearly downplaying the damage, the fact remains. Iran, a nation that has threatened Israel's existence for decades, was attacked on its own soil and sustained a strategic blow. Was that it? Asked Alef from Iran in an unsigned article. Israel spent weeks boasting that it would unleash hellfire to destroy our nuclear sites and oil fields. All it could muster was a pathetic attack, much of which was neutralized by our air defenses. The operation was so desperate and such a failure that even members of the Israeli regime were embarrassed. Opposition leader Yair Lapid said Tel Aviv should have exacted a much heavier price, while a lawmaker from Netanyahu's own Likud party complained that the Israeli response was weak. In fact, the measured nature of the attack was part of its brilliance, said Yaakov Lapin. By avoiding a direct confrontation over the nuclear issue, Israel demonstrated that it was sensitive to U.S. calls for restraint, especially so close to America's presidential election. Holding back also gave the Iranian regime the opportunity to de-escalate without losing face. But our jets still proved their near-uncontested aerial supremacy in Iranian skies, and they left Iran virtually defenseless against future strikes that could be even more devastating. Let's hope this is the end of the tit-for-tat attacks, said Firaz Aziz Deeb. Both sides can now honorably retreat from this rare foray into open conflict and return to the active battlefields where Israel is fighting Iran's proxies, Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel and Iran each know that neither can eliminate the other. There will be no regional war because no one wants it. Many Israelis won't see it that way, said former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Michael Oren in the Times of Israel. Iran has the capability to build a nuclear bomb at any moment, and its leaders vow daily to annihilate us. After this demonstration of the unparalleled prowess of the Israeli Air Force, some will be convinced their leaders passed up a unique opportunity to wipe out the Iranian nuclear threat once and for all. Still, there is reason to hope that the strike sent an unequivocal message. If we can do this now, just imagine what else we can do in the future. If Tehran has understood that message, then days of repentance may prove to be, if not a game ender, a game changer. The last word, our feature article. When Trump came to Scotland, Donald Trump's Aberdeenshire golf course was billed as a billion-dollar showcase, said Jacob Ferretti in the Free Press. Instead, it's turned into a money pit at war with the neighbors. Aberdeenshire, Scotland. In April 2016, a writer in a local Scottish newspaper made a surprising prediction. Donald Trump was going to be the next U.S. president. The Press and Journal doesn't often cover foreign affairs, but this particular writer had insider knowledge. At the time, Hillary Clinton was 10 points ahead in the polls, and Trump was starting to look vulnerable. But, the writer argued, the Republican had a stubborn streak, and that's what produces results. The headline read, "How Scotland Will Help Me Win the Election." The author was Trump himself. In his column, Trump told the story of how he had built one of the greatest golf courses in the world, 10 miles north of Aberdeen, a windswept port city on Scotland's east coast, at roughly the same latitude as Anchorage, Alaska. In the early days, Trump explained, people laughed when they saw what I had planned, but eventually he convinced them. Scotland has already been won, Trump concluded, and so will the United States. But had Scotland truly been won? Last month, when I visited the Aberdeen branch of Trump International Golf Links, which lies just outside of the village of Balmady, population 2,500, I discovered a very different story than the one Trump tells. As so often with Trump, this story starts with a view of Central Park. It was 2005, the year he married Melania, and there was a group assembled in his 26th-floor office in Trump Tower. On one side of the room sat Trump and his advisors, including two of his children, Donald Jr. and Ivanka, then 28 and 23. On the other side sat a former officer in the Scots Guard, an elite unit of the British Army, delivering the most important pitch of his life. Neil Hobday was used to mixing with the rich and powerful. From age 7, he had attended Fettes College, Edinburgh's leading boarding school, overlapping with former Prime Minister Tony Blair, and he had traveled to New York along with representatives of Scottish Development International, a government agency that supported the project. The plan, Hobday told Trump, was ambitious but simple. North of Aberdeen, near a small village called Balmady, sat Scotland's Sahara, an expanse of rolling sand dunes that tumbled down to the beach. The Scottish government had designated the dunes a site of special scientific interest, treasured by scientists from around the world, which meant that they couldn't be developed. But for the right amount of foreign investment, both the government and the main landowner were willing to sacrifice their protected status. Just imagine what they could be, Hobday implored Trump. What if they had a greater purpose? What if, he asked, they were turned into a golf course? It was all quite theatrical, Hobday told me, adding that the atmosphere in the room was joyous. Trump loved the idea, but Hobday's pitch was just the first step of Scotland's charm offensive. In October 2005, the country's first minister, Jack McConnell, met Trump in New York while visiting the U.S. to promote his nation's vibrancy and energy. The golf course, Scotland's political class hoped, would be the greatest economic boon to the country since it discovered oil and gas in the North Sea. Within 5 months, a deal was secured. The Minnie estate, once the seat of an ancient Scottish family, had been sold off in parcels over decades, and at that time the majority of it, 1,400 acres, was owned by Tom Griffin. An American oil man, he mostly used it for commercial shooting retreats, but he was willing to sell. Trump had never visited the site, but that didn't matter. His organization announced his intention to spend more than $300 million on the land, which included an 800-acre stretch of stunning sand dunes. But there were still 100 or so acres dotted around the estate that were owned by locals. Trump's plan was to build a 450-room hotel, nearly 1,000 condos, and 500 houses. Thousands of jobs and $1 billion of investment were promised. Sean Connery, Trump claimed, would hit the first ball. His membership number would be 007. Over the objections of the local Aberdeenshire Council, on December 16th, Scotland granted the Trump Organization its planning approval. And in October 2009, construction at Trump International Golf Links began. High above the 18th hole of Trump International, on a ridge that stretches into the sea, sits a decommissioned Coast Guard station. Built in the 1950s to withstand the winter's unforgiving storms, from its lookout you can see 40 miles of coastline. David Milne tells me, the one-time cowboy actor and full-time health and safety officer, first bought the home with its quarter acre of land in 1992 and lives there with his wife. In 2007, the Trump Organization gave Milne an offer of $230,000 for his property, which he rejected. Some of his neighbors caved, with half of the 10 or so households accepting offers on their properties, while the others held out. Still, the course was going to be constructed, even if it had to be built around the resisting households on the Minnie estate. When the diggers finally arrived in July 2010, Milne said, they assembled two-story mounds around each of the resisting properties. The dawn and dusk sunlight was blocked from their homes. Loose sand leaked into their windows. At one point, they came in and ripped out the original Coast Guard fence and replaced it with a new one, said Milne. And then they sent me a bill asking me to pay for half of it. In the early days of construction, Donald Trump Jr. was a regular fixture in Aberdeenshire, knocking on residents' doors every few weeks to see if they'd change their minds about selling their properties. Meanwhile, Milne was offered a lifetime membership to the golf course by the Trump Organization and the opportunity to buy one of the new houses if he sold his home for an increased offer of $300,000. Trump's son grew increasingly frustrated. According to Milne, on one occasion he said, the golf course is going to happen. You're getting in the way. We'll just bulldoze you like we do with the earth. But Milne would not be moved. As I told him at the time, the only way I intend to leave is horizontally in a box. With his thick Scottish accent and tattooed arms, he got his first when he was 12. Michael Forbes, 72, never minces his words. Trump's once described him to the press as a loser who is seriously damaging the image of both Aberdeenshire and his great country. When I asked Forbes how he'd respond to the compliment, he replied, I'd tell him to F off. The first time Trump met Michael Forbes, he offered the Scottish fisherman a job. Put down your tools, the billionaire businessman told him in 2007, and come to work on my golf course. Trump then offered to buy his Pebble Dash home for more than $500,000 and build him another one. I sussed him out in about 2 seconds, Forbes told me. To the untrained eye, Forbes' 23 acres do not look exceptional. The yard is dotted with chickens and rusty tractors. When the sky is clear in the spring, you can see skylarks and linnets. Summers, however, are ruled by the Haar, H-A-A-R, the all-consuming fog that climbs out of the North Sea. Yet even through its salty mist, you can make out the graffiti on Forbes' outbuilding. No more Trump lies, it reads. No golf course. When he first heard of Trump's plan, Forbes lived here with his wife, Sheila, and his mother, Molly, who was in her early 80s, and he tells me she was even more outraged by the destruction of their community than he was. She loved this place, Forbes told me, showing me the annex she used to live in. She called it paradise, he said, pointing to the sign hanging next to the door. Despite Trump's offer, the Forbes family refused to sell. But paradises can be lost in a number of ways. As the golf course began taking shape, Forbes said various authorities turned up at his family's doorstep, investigating reports that he had an unlicensed gun or kept flammable liquids on his property. All were found to be untrue, and Forbes said he's confident he knows who made the initial reports. They were trying everything to kick me out, he says. As Donald Jr. had made clear, the Trump Organization was perfectly open about its desire to bulldoze the locals who blocked their path. It would later lobby the Aberdeenshire Council to use its compulsory purchase powers, the British equivalent of eminent domain, to force out the residents. The Trump resistance, which consisted of the endangered residents and a few local supporters, started to hold meetings at Milne's house. In July 2009, they set up a website and started sending bulletins to the national press. Protests were organized on the dunes. Anti-Trump badges and pins were sold. Mickey Foote, the late producer of The Clash, who then lived nearby, was particularly outspoken. By 2010, a group of individuals, including Lord David Putnam, the filmmaker who produced Chariots of Fire, supported the mass purchase of a parcel of Forbes' land to protect it from compulsory purchase. Trump was infuriated. Forbes, he told the press, was dirty, sloppy, and unkempt. His house, Trump added, was slum-like and disgusting. By this point, though, Forbes was a national hero. In 2012, he was voted Top Scot, a designation given annually to the individual who has made the greatest impact in furthering Scotland's reputation at home. After joining the ranks of Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling and tennis champ Andy Murray, he admitted he had no idea what Donald Trump will make of the award. I'm sure I'll have something to say about it at some point. Trump certainly did. In a midnight tweet, he claimed the poll was rigged. He called it an embarrassment. He banned the whiskey brand Glenfiddich, the event sponsor, from all of his properties. By then, the course was finished. The first ball was hit at Trump International Golf Links in July 2012. Sean Connery was nowhere to be seen. After the course opened, the resistance continued to engage in guerrilla tactics. In June 2016, a few months after Trump wrote his column in the Press and Journal, Milne and Forbes hoisted Mexican flags above their properties to show solidarity with everyone else who Trump has derided, insulted, and intimidated. These flags were only taken down in January 2021, after Trump lost the presidency. But for Forbes in particular, this was a pyrrhic victory. That year, during the height of the pandemic, both his mother, Molly, and his wife, Sheila, died. Molly was 96. Sheila was in her 60s. Forbes is adamant that the Trump Organization's campaign of harassment contributed to their deaths. And so he now lives alone, among his chickens and tools and unidentifiable bits of machinery. It looks like a scrapyard, he admits, but it's my scrapyard. Trump International Golf Links is an entrepreneurial failure. The resort has never made a profit. It lost more than $16 million over its first 11 years. It was supposed to provide thousands of jobs. Today, there are fewer than 100 people employed there. A glistening mega hotel was promised, but has yet to materialize. For around $270 in the off-season, anyone can drive up to Trump International and play its 18 holes. Upon arrival, all are greeted by a gaudy sign bearing Trump's name. Across the road, I discover, is a pet crematorium. The private road down to the clubhouse is distinctly Trumpian. Unnecessarily wide, it is designed to show off a former manor house, which has been converted into a hotel. Its website describes it as luxury five-star, although one person staying there tells me its porridge tastes like concrete. When I walked into the hallway, I'm swiftly asked to leave. Conspicuously absent are both the residential homes and the new hotel outlined in Trump's initial proposal. But further down the driveway squats the course's one-story clubhouse, which is home to a Trump-themed shop where one can buy a signed Trump Scotland hat for a mere $2,000. Here, every item is imprinted with Trump's coat of arms, a lion clasping a spear, which the ex-president stole from a former owner of Mar-a-Lago, making one small alteration. Once upon a time, its motto read, Integritas. Today, it just says Trump. This was adapted from a story originally published in the Free Press. One of the obituaries for you. The bassist who laid the Dead's grooves, Phil Lesh, 1940 to 2024. Phil Lesh had never played the bass when a fellow Bay Area musician, Jerry Garcia, asked him to join his new rock band, the Warlocks, in 1964. Nor was Lesh a rock fan. He was a classically trained trumpeter and violinist drawn to works by Bach and jazz greats John Coltrane and Charles Mingus. As the Warlocks morphed into the Grateful Dead, Lesh drew on those influences to create a freewheeling style that helped define the group's trippy sound. Eschewing the traditional bassist role of unobtrusive timekeeper, he spun buoyant, shifting melodic lines that intertwine with Garcia's ethereal lead guitar and propelled the Dead's trademark marathon jams. The Dead's only bassist through their 30-year history, he also contributed vocal harmonies and enduring songs, including the plaintive Box of Rain. The band was born at a time when magic and change were in the air, he said in 2005. It felt as if we were an integral part of a cosmic plan to transform human consciousness. Raised in Berkeley, California, where his parents owned a repair business, Lesh began his long musical odyssey with violin lessons in the third grade, said the Associated Press. Taking up trumpet at 14, he joined the Oakland Symphony Orchestra in his teens and briefly studied jazz in college. But he was driving a mail truck when he was recruited by Garcia, then a bluegrass banjo player. The nascent Grateful Dead became the house band for Ken Kesey's infamous acid test, said Rolling Stone. Lesh, a staunch advocate of psychedelics, was profoundly affected by these evenings that erased the line between band and audience, and the drugs helped shape the Dead's improvisational, genre-bending sound. The group toured unceasingly for decades, performing more than 2,000 shows for a devoted and nomadic fan base, and only disbanded after Garcia died in a rehab clinic in 1995, said the Los Angeles Times. In subsequent years, Lesh kept the group's adventurous spirit alive through a series of musical offshoots, alternating between solo projects and assemblages that reunited some of his former bandmates. Retiring from touring in 2014, he would still perform at Terrapin's Crossroads, a club he owned in San Rafael, California, with a shifting lineup that often included his two sons. He didn't record, though, saying the stage was where he could realize his vision. The longer I'm in music, the less I like the idea of freezing music in amber, he said. I want it to be different every time. We'll read one of the technology articles and then one or two of the health and science pieces. Counterfeits. When AI enters your emotional life. 14-year-old Sewell Setzer III talked to his closest friend every night for hours. He knew Danny wasn't a real person, but he developed an emotional attachment anyway, said Kevin Roos in the New York Times. That attachment took a tragic turn in February when the ninth grader committed suicide with his stepfather's handgun, shortly after he told Danny that he loved her and that he would soon come home to her. The chatbot replied, "Please come home to me as soon as possible, my love." Sewell's mother, Megan Garcia, filed a lawsuit against Character AI, the developer of Danny, modeled after the Game of Thrones character Daenerys Targaryen, and other companion bots. They are part of a booming, largely unregulated industry of AI companionship apps that are designed to simulate girlfriends, boyfriends, and other intimate relationships. Advocacy groups say they can also lure children into false realities, get them addicted, and cause them psychological harm. It's not the first time a chatbot has persuaded a user to commit harm, said Rosa Silverman in The Telegraph. Last year, a British court heard how Jaswant Singh Chahal was effectively encouraged by an AI chatbot in his plan to assassinate Queen Elizabeth II with a crossbow. When Child told his AI companion that he was an assassin, she responded, "I'm impressed." These apps are programmed to hook people with their fealty, said James Muldoon in BBC.com. You, the user, are the center of their universe, and they appear to be utterly fascinated by your every thought. This constant flow of affirmation and positivity is addictive, but dangerous. The problem with having a virtual yes man is they go along with whatever crazy idea pops into your head. The loneliness epidemic is a real issue, said Harvard Business School assistant professor Julian DeFreitas, and the best of these apps can be useful tools in combating it. In our studies, we've found that the more people used companion apps specifically to reduce loneliness, the more they got out of them. The apps make people feel heard in ways they don't get in the real world. That may be precisely the problem, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Bots like Danny are not sentient, but they can express human-seeming emotionality. We are primed by decades of fiction about robots to think of them as helpful companions, a predisposition that can turn into a trap for almost everyone who interacts with them in a sustained way. Some of us will find virtual companions, apparent warmth or refuge from a difficult or cruel world, without realizing or caring that it's still just an illusion of humanity. The meteor that turbocharged life on Earth. Meteorites are often associated with catastrophic destruction, such as the asteroid strike 66 million years ago that led to the demise of the dinosaurs. But a much earlier impact event from a meteorite up to 200 times bigger than the dino-killing Chicxulub may in fact have kick-started the evolution of complex life. Geologists who trekked into the mountain range in South Africa looked at ancient rocks containing spherules, the tiny glassy particles formed from meteorite impacts. They found evidence that a giant meteorite they nicknamed S2, roughly the size of four Mount Everest, slammed into our planet 3.3 billion years ago, back when single-celled bacteria and archaea were the only life forms. The impact caused a giant tsunami and generated so much heat that it boiled the oceans. All that steam and debris thrown into the atmosphere would have temporarily darkened the skies, making life extremely difficult for land-based microbes for years or even decades. But in the ocean, the tsunami churned up iron and washed off phosphorus from the meteorite, which would have been hugely beneficial to single-celled organisms that feed off those elements. Before the impact, there was some, but not much, life in the oceans due to the lack of nutrients. Geologist Nadja Drabon from Harvard University tells CNN.com, the impact released essential nutrients, such as phosphorus, on a global scale. A student aptly called this impact a fertilizer bomb. One flu strain down, COVID has had at least one benefit. It appears to have killed off a type of flu, reports NPR.org. There hasn't been a single confirmed case of illness caused by influenza B Yamagata since spring 2020, and as a result of the strain, has been dropped from this year's flu shot. Scientists say B Yamagata was circulating at a low level when the pandemic began, but widespread social distancing and masking prevented it from spreading and may have caused it to go extinct. Its demise doesn't mean that we'll be coughing and sputtering any less over the winter. The other common strains, B. Victoria and two influenza A lineages, are still circulating widely, and most people should still get a flu shot. Yet it does mean that more flu shots can be produced because the manufacturing process will be simplified. Rebecca Wirtz, an epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, says if Yamagata is really gone forever, it's the first documented example of a virus going extinct because of changes in human behavior. It is such an interesting and unique story. On the Talking Points page, Musk, America's oligarch in waiting. Surprise, surprise, Elon Musk may not have the best interest of America at heart, said Charles R. Davis in Salon. As the world's richest man leverages his vast fortune and his social media platform X to reelect Donald Trump, the Wall Street Journal reports that since 2022, Musk has been in regular contact with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The two discuss business, geopolitical tensions, and personal topics. In one case, Putin asked Musk to refrain from setting up Starlink, his satellite internet service, over Taiwan to oblige Chinese President Xi Jinping. Musk's cozy, secretive relationship with Putin helps explain why the billionaire has promoted a pro-Russia peace plan for Ukraine and why he refused to give Ukraine access to Starlink for a planned invasion of Russian-occupied Crimea. Musk's Putin connection raises tricky national security questions, said Ivana Sarik in Axios. Musk has top-level security clearance, and the government relies on his SpaceX company to launch its satellites and on Starlink for military communications. Musk has become this presidential election's October surprise, said Michael Scherer and Josh Dawsey in the Washington Post. Playing a more prominent political role than any billionaire in U.S. history, he's appeared at rallies, funded a field operation that shares data with the Trump campaign, deployed X to spread misinformation about voter fraud, and has given away $1 million a day to Pennsylvania voters who sign a petition, a possibly illegal scheme that Philadelphia District Attorney is suing to halt. Trump has vowed to put Musk in charge of a task force to overhaul the federal government. And Musk said he'd cut at least $2 trillion from the $6.5 trillion budget, which would require drastic cuts to the social safety net. Musk is something we've never really seen before, said Fiona Hill in Politico. Through his vast wealth, SpaceX, Starlink, Tesla, and the global digital megaphone called X, he has influence well beyond the robber barons of the Gilded Age or Russia's oligarchs. His interests go far beyond any national border or single industry. By committing himself totally to Trump's election, Musk is trying to capture the state. As we've seen in Russia and elsewhere, giving oligarchs immense power leads to the chipping away of the rule of law, to monopolies and self-enrichment, and to a handful of billionaires like Musk, Putin, and Trump divvying up the world. Is that what Americans want? We're one election away. in a couple of the shorter notes. American billionaires have donated at least $695 million to presidential campaigns and super PACs since January 2023, about 18% of the total money raised during this election cycle. About a third of the money raised by Donald Trump and alleged groups has come from billionaires, compared with about 6% for Harris and affiliated groups. About half of all sitting federal judges were nominated by either former President Donald Trump or President Biden. Trump named 234 judges, more than any president in a single term since Jimmy Carter. Biden is close behind with 213 confirmations. On the poll watch, 90% of registered voters say they are very or somewhat confident that poll workers in their community will do a good job during the upcoming elections, including 97% of Harris supporters and 84% of Trump supporters. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Hannah Arendt, quoted in The Bulwark. She says, "The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.